This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
You are listening to Into the Comics Cave with your host, comic book heartthrob, Grant Stoy.
Hello, people, we're doing another bad opening. I'm still Grant. I'm still bad at this. But today we have a writer who I enjoy from his comic book Yeti work and also from a book you may have already backed, Mechaton, and currently coming out, Frankenstein Unconquered. We have
Frankenstein the Unconquered.
I forgot the V.
You forgot the V.
I feel like I'm in seventh grade again.
Articles, so important.
It's Wells Thompson. Hello, Wells.
Hey, Grant, how you doing?
I'm great. Because this is a visual medium, I need to point out that you're wearing a walrus onesie, and it is just immaculate.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I did my homework before coming on the podcast. I wanted to wanted to impress you with my knowledge. That I had thought to maybe like listen to a couple of episodes and see what the general vibe was before I hopped on.
Well, it's lucky for you. I'm impressed by like basic math. Because
oh wonderful.
Helping my fourth grade daughter with her homework is always like a Russian roulette situation.
I'm pretty good at basic math, I gotta say. Like I'm a server in my day job, and we do a tip pool, and it's like one step removed from being like entirely basic. So it's like very slightly complicated, and for some reason everyone is like, "Wells, do it for me," because I don't know how. I'm like, it's just 30 points for every server, 5 points for the host. That's all it is.
You guys not tip out back of the house?
No, they make salary. They make hourly.
Man, well, yeah.
I make $4 an hour, Grant. I make $4.
And this is why we fight for, I believe, in a restaurant reform.
I agree. No, I 100% agree. Tips are a terrible system. Tips were born out of the Great Depression.
Really?
Yeah, no, so the idea was, like, tips used to be considered un-American. It used to be considered, like, a form of bribery. Like, it was a European thing. Like, you would hand the, you know, server, you know, 20 euro or whatever they, francs, whatever, and be like, hey, take extra special care of me. And, yes, sir, absolutely. And it was considered, like, very rude in America. Like, no, this is a land of freedom. You don't do that. And I am also cutting out the racial undertones of that, which is to say it was common to tip black people because they were considered lesser than you. That's a whole different can of worms. All that to say, when the Great Depression hit and restaurants were unable to pay their staff, they said, well, you better start accepting tips. And they did to survive. And then they just never went back to like the actual like paying your employees.
Dude, I worked over 10 years in the restaurant biz, and I never learned that. So my mind is sufficiently blown.
Yeah, there's a lot of dirty secrets in the food industry.
Well, speaking of food, what was your favorite meal growing up?
Ooh. Okay, so I grew up in Arkansas, and I learned late in life that cheese dip is an Arkansas thing. Like, yeah, exactly. You don't know what I'm talking about.
Like, all I'm thinking about is like the Schuller cheese in the grocery store.
No, no, this is essentially like, and there's like a redneck version of it, which is specifically Velveeta and Rotel melted in the microwave, and that is delicious. Nothing is wrong with that. But you can also like, you can do so much more with it. You can throw chili and so much interesting stuff in there. But that is like my original comfort food as an Arkansan is cheese dip. which some people have now adopted to calling queso, and that, and it's not actually even like a, you can ask Jared Lujan, it's not a Mexican dish. It is, it originates from like Hope, Arkansas.
That is both informative and kind of depressing.
Isn't it though?
Well, tell me a little bit more about growing up in Arkansas. Like, you alluded earlier that you had a brother. How many people were in your family?
So I have a very strange kind of family situation. I have, my mom and dad were married for about 3 years, or maybe a little longer than that. I'm just, the frame of reference that is relevant to me, I was born in 93, they divorced in 96, so.
Okay.
They were married sometime before they had me. And going into that marriage, they both had a son. Dad had my brother George, mom had my brother Turner, and they are now like best friends.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And so like that, we didn't all grow up together or anything. I grew up with Turner and occasionally saw George, and then like only when they were in high school did they have really any access to each other, and they went to high school together and were like, oh yes, we're best friends. I think their friendship
awesome.
Started with like, hey, do you have a copy of Counter-Strike? I really want to. And then they just like went over to each other's house, started playing Counter-Strike. So that's the beautiful origin story of how all of my family came together. So I have two half brothers, and also my dad has another adopted son from a previous marriage. So ex step brothers, if you will. I don't know.
But that's a fun family unit.
Yeah,
it's nice
no,
that
we
there
had
were other people there, and you weren't some only child.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We were the Thompson boys, which I wish there, I wish we had a band with that kind of gumption I just brought to it, but it wasn't
it's
that
never
glamorous.
Too late.
It's never too late. I think it is. I play music pretty well. George abandoned playing drums like a long time ago, and Turner is really sporadic with how he learns anything. Like, he just wants to pick something up, get really into it for like a month, and then never touch it again. So he to his credit, he did stick with the ukulele for a while, for a
nice.
Really long time. So he does know how to play the ukulele.
All right, I still would buy your debut album with the Thompson Boys.
Thompson Boys.
And what were your reading habits like as a child?
That's a good question. I feel like I resented reading as a kid, like particularly very young, because my mom was very like pro education. It's probably her best quality, I'll say, was that she was like extremely for us being highly educated, making good decisions for ourselves, being able to like navigate life from an informed standpoint. And she wanted me to read all the time, and I wanted to play Ocarina of Time all the time.
Ooh.
So we had a conflict there. I'll say, like, I somewhat grew into it. I think I found, like, my love of reading in high school, really.
Yeah.
Like, with Kurt Vonnegut novels, and I kind of started backwards on comics. I read Watchmen, and I read Mouse and Persepolis. So I did like the absolute hardcore literary stuff, and then worked my way into the funny books. In fact, the origin story of my becoming a writer, I remember this vividly, was the summer going into sixth grade, I had to read Secret Garden, which is a trash novel by it's probably not that bad. I remember hating it a lot. I remember hating it so much I thought to myself, I can do better than this. And then I started writing short stories, and they were bad, obviously. I was in sixth grade. What do you want from me? But I never gave up on it. I kept doing it.
Just like the fact, the Secret Garden. The only reason I know the Secret Garden is like, I think there was a Shirley Temple movie based off it or something.
Yeah, it sounds right.
And it's just obviously depressing books about depressing things, and being required reading, you're just like, Why are you doing this? Why are you?
It's terribly. There's a character that's like terminally in a wheelchair, and he's like given up on life, and she has to like convince him that life is worth. It's been a long time since I've read it, but I remember that. I remember there's a jump roping sequence. There's like
it was hard for the guy in the wheelchair.
Fun. What was hard for the guy in the wheelchair?
He was the jump rope. Sounds like it was hard for the guy in the wheelchair.
Oh. It was an incredibly forward-thinking book. You had animatronic legs all the way back then. No.
It's actually an Edgar Rice Burroughs book about the future.
That would have been much more entertaining to read. I do think in general that, I don't know if it's the requiring of reading or the fact that all required reading is boring. Like, they just happen to pick boring books to read.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something about that like rigid system that kills people's love of reading. And I wish we, I mean, that is not the first or last thing that needs to be tackled as far as education reform goes in this country, but it is one thing that dearly, like, I wish people like kids had a little bit more choice in what they read, as they are growing.
Right. And When did you start reading comics? 'Cause Watchmen.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like you have to be a teenager to get that.
Yeah, no, I was I was probably 10th or 11th grade was when I picked up Watchmen. And I just loved it immediately. Like, I didn't understand like the commentary they were doing on like the superhero genre in comics necessarily, but I really enjoyed the everything about it, the writing style, depth of character, the kind of pacing of it. It was one of the first things that I read that I really went, oh, you're allowed to make scumbag characters that, like, they don't learn a lesson, but you get to learn a lesson through them. You know, you get to watch Rorschach be a bad person and go, I don't want to be that.
Right.
Or if you're an edgelord, I do want to be that.
I was going to say, at 16, you learn more than a lot of adults.
I mean, I knew that Rorschach was not a good person, for sure. I probably thought he was a lot cooler then than I do now. But yeah, even then I was like, this guy's a little crazy. And his moral code is all over, as much as he wants to believe it's like black and white, it is all over the place.
Right.
There's a lot of interesting stuff I could talk about with that particular book. I like that they have like a Superman figure in that book, and they go out of their way to make put all the agency in the human characters.
Yeah.
And it's like a very mature take on Superman. Again, I could just keep going. Like, that lethargy of I am burdened with so much knowledge, it's just hard for me to relate to people anymore. And I don't understand why I need to care about any of this.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. Because you have such like salient observations on Watchmen itself, and you've got such a good critical eye, what came first, the critique of comics or the creation of comics?
Oh, the critique, 100%. I approached from a literary standpoint first. I wanted to be a novelist. Let's be clear about that. Like, that was my goal. I wanted to be short story writer, novelist. I have a novel in my drawer right now. And sort of the reality of publishing was what turned me off to that world. Like, I've written so many short stories. Some of them are even good. And like, none of them have ever been published in anything but like college literary magazines. And I just kept, it just like kept beating me down and beating me down and beating me down. And then I really transitioned from there into screenwriting, where with a lot of my friends in college, including Dalton Shannon, who is my co-writer on most of the things that I write, we went into digital filmmaking. He went into digital filmmaking. I went into writing. And then I would write the screenplays for my friends and help them with their like stories. We would make films, and I would like, that's for best actor. Oh, here it is. This is my Red Brick Film Festival best writing.
Oh, you that's cool. That.
Yeah, it's a brick with a plaque on it. But yeah, I won that for a that was 2017, 2016. So that was for adulting. That was for a mockumentary about what it's like to become an adult. That reads very like, what's that? The training video episode of SpongeBob.
I don't like, think I've seen that. You have to remember, I'm also 65 years old.
That's true. Sorry. So yeah, there's a very famous episode of SpongeBob where they're doing like a Krusty Krab instructional training video. And there's a narrator who's very sassy and like, they're just kind of going step by step through the day. And the main character is becoming like more and more impatient, wanting to get to the point. And he's like, slow down, SpongeBob. First, we need to talk about hygiene. But yeah, anyway, so I did a lot of screenwriting with my friends in college, and when we graduated, I wanted to keep making stuff, and so did they, but they were kind of lazy about it, mm-hmm. I guess. And it got, like, I was trying to, like, get us to, like, you know, start doing YouTube stuff and making videos and podcasts and, like, make shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I learned really quickly is the more you, like, push people to do your vision who don't, like, share your vision, the more they're just gonna not do it.
Yes.
Like, you can't make them, you know.
They will not do it harder.
Yeah, exactly. And I got really frustrated with that, and I started writing my first novel. So great. So I was like, I want to do just totally solo work, whatever. And that was really fulfilling. But again, novels are very hard to publish. Such to the point that I once went to a writer conference, explained it to someone, and they were like, that sounds incredible. No one will touch that.
Would you think, sir?
Yeah. I was like, thank you. That's so helpful. They were like, it is way too esoteric for like a first novel. And I'm like, well, it is my first novel. So what am I supposed to do with that information? And then I told them the pitch behind one of my graphic novel ideas. And they were like, I will sell that immediately. You call me the second you have artwork, which was a fun experience. I never did call them back, but that's fine. I don't have any artwork for it either. We'll get there eventually. It's all in the plan.
So, in the midst of your creating, do you have anything you need, like, playing in the background? Because some people have YouTube videos, some people put on movies, some people sit in stone cold silence and listen to their heartbeat, you know, like psychos do.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I can't listen to the entropy of creation like that and just be expected to. No, I can't, like, listen to the world crumbling around me and just continue to write. Almost always, I have some kind of music on. I used to make playlists, like I have a bunch of albums set aside for, like, this is what I'm working on for In the Pines, and this is when I'm working on Depths and things like that. The more I've been working recently, the more I feel I get distracted by the music. So I've been, I literally just put on, like, go to YouTube and type in lo-fi for witches, and whatever I haven't listened to, there's like 800 videos, and I just, like, whatever I haven't listened to yet, I click on it, and it's like a 2.5 hour long video, and I just go.
That's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's like the ambient noise. It's like the perfect meeting place between, like, more interesting than a rain machine, but not so interesting I'm going to be distracted by it.
It seems like a lot of folks get by with that lo-fi. Like, for instance, the lo-fi beats playlist on Spotify is, yeah, like the most popular creative playlist.
Yeah, it's super background in the best way possible. Like, it's not there to interfere with you. It's just there to, like, take your mind off of the present, off of, like, what is going on in the immediate vicinity around you.
Is that what you're listening to for Frankenstein?
A little, yeah. I mean, that's what I listened to the last script that I wrote, for sure. I just plugged it in and sort of let my mind wander in a coffee shop somewhere in downtown Nashville.
Now, I'm curious, when you're tackling like a major fictional character like Frankenstein's monster, Did you avoid like anything like the Mary Shelley Frankenstein movie or even Young Frankenstein to extent? Anything with that character that might push you feeling in a certain way?
As in, like, did I go out of my way not to watch or read anything? I'm a big lover of all things horror, and I really love that that book. So the short answer is no. In fact, I really wanted this. I wanted to kind of. I can't take all the credit, obviously. Dalton is a huge part of. Dalton was the one who had the original idea for Frankenstein. Dalton is a huge part of the reason why we decided to pursue this particular story. But certainly, like, we both had a lot of input into who Frankenstein would be, because it is an established character. People know who it is. And I made a conscious choice. I wanted it to be closer to the Mary Shelley Frankenstein than, like, popular notions and, like, universal horror. Right. Even though, and, like, universal horror monsters are frequently referenced in our scripts for this particular series. And we want that association to be there, but I really wanted to dive back into the literary roots for this one. Because there's a lot there to chew on. And I feel like it's, especially when you have him like as a protagonist, it's a lot more interesting than the universal horror, like kind of mindless, nothing there, just killing machine.
Oh yeah.
And he sort of projects that way sometimes in the comic. I don't know if, did I bother to show you any of the preview art? I don't remember.
I've just seen the incredible Heather Vaughn cover with the Brenda Snell.
Gotcha. We have five completed pages right now.
Right,
yeah, that we're sort of dropping on Twitter and previewing and are gonna be on the Kickstarter page. But like he sort of presents as like a move forward, kill everything, like, you know, unfeeling machine. But that is very much a front.
Mm-hmm.
That is him kind of protecting himself from the world that he grew up in and has been dropped in, which is in a way like meets him where he is. It is hostile, it is ugly, and in a way like it allows him to thrive, and at the same time it doesn't judge him in the same way that like, you know, Mary Shelley's world did, but he still has the baggage of that world.
Okay.
And he carries that with him. It's very much a story about like toxic masculinity and being more than is necessary to a damaging degree. And I can't wait to tell it. I'm going to be honest.
Hello there. My name is Don Cardenas, and I'm here to invite you to check out my podcast, the 2021 Granty Award-winning Comics Coffee Metal, where I interview creatives in, around, and about the worlds of, you guessed it, comics, coffee, and metal. I've already had such amazing guests on my show, including, but not limited to, Liana Kangas, Mike Norton, John O'Diener, Michael Conrad, Sophie Campbell, Guitar Max Carlisle, Andrew Baina, and of course, the Word Bros themselves, Bob and Kevin. Comics Coffee Metal is available on all the major podcast services, and you can find it directly at comicscoffeemetal.com. I hope to see you there. And now I return you to Into the Comics Cave with the amazing, awesome, talented, tall, handsome, what else did I say? Definitely over 6 feet tall, smells good like lavender and motorcycle grease. Is that right? Motorcycle grease? All right. Grant Stoy.
There, I said it. Get my money now.
So, I have a weird question to ask you.
Please.
And I tailored it specifically to tie in with Frankenstein.
Love that.
How many different dicks do you think Dr. Frankenstein looked at before choosing the one he put on Frankenstein's monster?
Oh. Well, he picked the most beautiful body parts that he could find. Canonically, I love that he's not ugly because, like, he's hideous. He's ugly because all these different body parts are beautiful individually but don't work together. So I think it's actually, like, two or three. Like, he got He got the head off of one particularly beautiful penis, like the dick vein off of another. He got the testicles off of a third, probably the shaft off of a fourth. He put a lot of work into the individual parts of the dick and balls. So if there's a 4 to 5 different dicks on Frankenstein right now, I'm going to say he probably looked at about 80 or 90 before he settled.
That takes it in a place I was not expecting. I was thinking that he would just lop the things off. Like, even to say there, he's got like the scrotum with the balls and the penis. Like, he just put those, not like pieces of different things. I wasn't thinking Frankensteining a dick.
No, he's Frankensteining the whole thing. That's the point.
Amazing.
Oh, God.
Now we got to really think about this. Like, how would, because this is what, in the late 1700s when?
The original novel comes out, I believe, in 1812.
Okay.
1818. There we go.
Oh, that's pretty close.
1818.
So, like, the decomposition structure, they're not that big into, like, embalming at that point, are they?
There are certainly embalming methods.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, myrrh, like, they certainly knew about embalming. And even if you track it further, like, mummification is a type of embalming. So,
yeah.
Certainly that would exist to some degree. How widespread it was for very common common people in the 1800s, I do not know.
So I'm just curious about, like, what the turnaround is for comparing and contrasting all those different ball bags.
I don't know. It would probably pretty fresh. I'm not going to lie. Probably you have to go pretty fresh. Or you have to go very aristocratic. He might have some, like, Duke's testicles or something like that. Someone who could afford that sort of embalming procedure and that would last a while.
Or do you think he was, like, in the gentleman's club, like, perusing the showers, just checking people out and cruising and stuff?
Well, he didn't murder anybody to make the...
What if he's like, well, you know, you are very old, sir, but your giant elephantine ball sack could be very well harvested.
I mean, that's always a possibility, but he did have to work with what was already dead. Yeah. Which, and that is another thing to think about. He worked with oversized parts on purpose, so... Am I saying Frankenstein has a Ron Jeremy-sized penis? Absolutely I am. And when he comes down from the comet, spoilers, naked on a comet, ready to murder some folk. And we had many conversations about whether or not we should see Frankenstein's penis. And you and I have something in common, Grant, and that is, I think... both of us are at some point in our careers going to be asked, where is the dick cut? Because I've read your work as well. Side quest number one is a great place for a dick. There's a whole logo in front of it. You went way out of your way to cover it up. So where is it, Grant?
So I'm glad that you so openly discussed Frankenstein's dick.
Oh, absolutely.
And now I just got to think about, you know, him perusing the morgue.
There was a great, in the original short that we did for Frankenstein the Unconquered, which if you didn't know, it was a short that just shows how lackluster you are as a reviewer, that you would not do the research.
I'm actually illiterate.
Oh, that makes sense. All right. No, I'm not surprised. Descent into Dread is not, like, the most popular, but our original, here we go, Descent into Dread. No one's going to see the video. I don't know why I'm showing you this. But, yeah, you can see the original, like, drawing of Frankenstein.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It's just very shadowy, and there's a couple shots where you're like, dude, you cannot go any closer without showing some serious brain.
Or he's got an obsidian wiener that just takes up the whole mass of his left thigh.
That would be a twist. This is just the whole thing. Okay, here you go. This is actually, this particular panel, you can kind of see he actually doesn't grow pubic hair, apparently. Like, it is incredibly shaved.
Well, you're riding around a comet, you know, you have to reduce friction.
It is Manscaped to a frightening degree.
So, speaking of manscaping, I've got some bad news.
Okay.
You actually went to your favorite Brazilian waxer, and they were giving you the treatment. What?
Tiffany, yeah.
Yeah, she's giving you the treatment. It's a great, great time until she waxes you incorrectly and just rips one of your, is it femoral arteries, like right out of your leg?
Yeah, femoral.
Yeah.
Near so the femur.
Yeah, you bleed to death, smooth as a baby, and you're dead, and I'm sorry.
At least I was smooth.
Yeah, at least you were smooth.
At least I was smooth.
Because you've listened to the questions before, I'm doing them in reverse order.
No, oh, beautiful.
You get
tripping
to have
me up.
You get to heaven naked as a jaybird, and there's Jack Kirby. And what do you think he says to you?
You're not hairy enough to be a Jew. I think that's what he says. And I say, fair enough, I'm not practicing. You have a good day, sir.
You shake hands and part ways.
Yeah.
That's lovely. Wells, what is your favorite swear word that's not a swear word?
Ooh. So the one I, like, what I do when I need to swear usually is just say fuck, but when I can't swear, what I'll do is just turn it into, like, syllables. I'll just be like, I'll just kind of dissolve my words into nothing speech.
Because also, as a server, do you feel comfortable swearing in front of a customer if, like, say, a glass gets dropped?
It depends on the context. Because there's different, like, you know, it depends on the rapport that I built with them, the vibe that I get off the table, how old they are, you know. But I've someone, like, I think 2 days ago, someone cursed in front of me, looked at me and was like, I'm so sorry. And I went, watch your fucking mouth. And I got a big laugh from the table, so.
That is a feeling I do miss.
So yeah, no, it's all context sensitive, but yeah, there was one that what was it? By the Horns does one that that grew on me. I didn't like it at first, but it's Frax.
Yes.
FRAX. And, like, I thought it was dumb at first. I was just like, I just don't like substitute swear words. But the more they said it, the more natural it felt. And I actually grew to really like it. So Fraxing.
Fraxing is good.
Fraxing is pretty good.
Number three. What is something you dislike about sequential art?
That I don't like about sequential art? Ooh. I don't like how everyone feels exploited, but we're only capable of pointing the finger at each other.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, writers feel super exploited because we basically have to pay to play.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have to hire everybody. I mean, you don't have to, I guess, but if you want to get anywhere, you definitely have to.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we are very easily burned, you know, if an artist, I mean, all the way from, like, lied to you about wanting to be on your project and then took the money and ran, all the way to, like, maybe got sick, had a life event come up and legitimately couldn't, but, like, can very easily just fuck an entire project by, you know, getting paid thousands of dollars to make pages and making, you know, maybe doing all of them or most of them, but not being able to carry on a project or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you can lose a lot of money in this industry doing nothing. And then artists, and they're right. I'm not trying to start a flame war on Twitter. Artists are very, like, you know, defensive about, you know, their part of the creative process and feel like they get fucked out of a lot of credit and like they should amount to more, and like writers are out to fuck them sometimes, which can certainly be true. And what drives me crazy, not only that that happens, like creating art should not cost this much money on anyone's part, but that we seem to only be capable of like pointing to the other and going, it's your fault, instead of being like, wow, why is this market broken? Yeah. Why is this market so inherently broken that no one can make their money back on like on a comic book? Like, it when the guy writing Batman is making like 50 grand a year, something's wrong. Yeah. Like, it's not a good state of a system. If television writers were making paid to make television, paid their own money to make a TV show, we would have no more TV. I don't understand how comics even continue to get made at this point.
Oh, I like doing the questions reversed, because now we go, what is something that you love about sequential art?
I love the collaboration.
Oh, hell yeah.
I love getting to do the part that I'm really good at, moving it on to someone else, and then working with them to make it better. Because like, there's so many stories that I've worked on that I thought, this is as good as I can ever make it, this is as good as it'll ever be, and then an artist comes along and is like, what if we did this? And I'm like, yes, oh my god, yes, it's so much better. I think comics is like the ultimate. It is small enough that you get to make it. you get to work, like, you get to work. It's big enough you get to work with people. It's small enough it actually gets done. For expensive but not unreasonable cost a lot of the time. And you really get to see on every step of the way how it gets better and how people's bring their own ideas into it, and it improves and becomes something bigger than what was in your head originally.
Yeah. And we're going to close out with what is your favorite sequential art sound effect?
Ooh. So I would be remiss if I didn't bring up this guy.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
For those painting. Who are unable to see through the sound waves, it's actually like a boom. It's a like a document. What is that, a painting?
No, it's a painting. It's a canvas painting.
Oh, that's wild. It's a painting that has a boom that looks like it was in the Batman 66 TV show.
Yeah, I love it. So this specific boom is probably my favorite. But in terms of like what is in a comic, I have a couple different answers. Let me take a second to step outside the question and say lettering is one of my favorite parts, because there's so much creative shit you can do with it, and nothing makes me more excited than to see like Aditya Bidikar is on a book, or Hassan is on a book, or, you know, just like seeing a really good letterer do their thing is incredible. In Mechaton, there's this cool thing that Nathan did where when the creature Dihedapod comes, like runs onto the set, he makes this horrible scream.
Oh, that's wild.
And it's like a QR code almost. It's like staticky. Because it's just like horrifying raw noise that you can't really even capture. And like you could, I guess we could have gone rah, but it's like, this is so much like more visceral to me.
Oh, absolutely.
So I really love that. But if I had to pick like one very common, I guess, word, that's my favorite sound effect, it's probably squelch.
That feels like it has multiple usages.
It's for me, it's anything that is wet and sloppy and gross, and it like it sounds the way it is, the way it, like everything about it just is so cohesive.
I like ending on squelch.
Squelch.
Wells, you are a walrus-tastic, delightful person. Where can folks find you on the socials?
I'm most frequently on Twitter at Wells Thomp. WELLSTHOMP. I do have a newsletter that you can find a way to sign up for. I will try and make it easy. If you, I'll set something up on Twitter. If nothing else is pinned, then I'll make that my pin. But we talk about it's called Comics Comics, Cats and Cocktails. And we talk about comics, cats and cocktails. I show you like pictures of my foster cats. I share a cocktail recipe from my many years of the serving and bartending experience, and I talk about comics.
Well, that's a good combination.
Yeah, right. It's got a little everything. Where else? I'm on Ko-fi. Coffee.
Very important.
Whatever. Yeah, absolutely. You can pick up Mechaton or just give me money there. That is always appreciated. And very likely at any given point in time, I am running a Kickstarter campaign. So keep an eye out for that. And I will 100% notice if you contribute to that campaign because I refresh the page constantly.
Thank God for mobile apps.
Oh my God, it ruins my life.
Well, dude, thank you so much for joining us and putting up with my nonsense. I was very looking forward to having you.
I came for the nonsense, Grant. I 100% came for the nonsense.
This has been a Comic Book Yeti production. You can find new episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and anywhere podcasts stream. For more information on the Comic Book Yeti, please visit comicbookyeti.com. And for more of Grant, visit grantstoy.com or on Twitter @grantandstuff.